Hey guys, welcome to Current Geek. Before we get things started, I just wanted to make a note here that our guest today, or one of our guests, Jenny's here. Everyone loves Jenny, right? She's great. One of our guests is Juan Benitez, who is on the show for a couple of reasons. One, he just seemed like a cool guy, but also he's the CTO and GM over there at Braintree, and they've sponsored the show before, as you've heard in the past. It's a little unusual for us to have a sponsor on the show, but I really liked his perspective on stuff and thought he would be an interesting guest. But it also gave them a chance to talk a little bit more about what they do. And toward the end of the show, you'll notice that there's a portion of the show that is kind of a Q&A for him that may to people seem like an infomercial, and I guess that's kind of what it is. He wanted to promote who they are a bit. But I wanted you to be aware of that beforehand. Full disclosure, they are an advertiser or a potential advertiser, and turned out to be a pretty good guest too. So there you go. Welcome to the show. Have fun. Keep your hands and feet in the cart at all times, and we'll see you on the other side.
I have
Current Geek!
Current Geek!
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Current Geek. This is Current Geek, the weekly proceedings of the meetings of the Frog Pants All-Stars, geeks of the world, and you to keep you current on all things that matter most. I'm Scott Johnson, and that guy with the mallet is Tom Merritt. Hey, Tom.
It's a gavel. Gavel. Very similar to the kind used by Justice Antonin Scalia and or Ruth Bader Ginsburg, depending on where you stand on things.
Sure.
Almost forgot it.
Yeah. Is that what you hopped up a second ago?
Yeah, if anybody was watching the live video, it saw me scamper back. I realized as you were beginning the theme song that I didn't have this in my hand.
It's really important. Tom will use that later to judge.
We can't open
contest.
The weekly proceedings of the meetings of the Frog Pants All-Stars without a gavel.
I completely agree. It's good to be here, everybody. Welcome to the show. Man, what a day, but it's time for us to pull one off, so we're going to do it. And as always, we have guests. Let's start with someone who's returning to the show. We'll bring her up first. And ladies first, it's Jenny Josephson, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, hello.
Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
How
it's
are
so
you?
Lovely to be here.
It's great to have you here. I feel like we just did this, but it's been a couple of weeks, so it's nice to have you back on. Jenny does all kinds of stuff, and we'll get into that later. She's like kind of ruling our world these days. So, Jenny, thanks for being here. Also with us, the CTO and GM of BraintreePayments.com, Mr. Juan Benitez joins us on the line. Hey, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks. Great to be here on a Friday.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. I know you've had some crazy busy meetings this afternoon. We appreciate you taking your time and hanging out with us.
Very happy to be here.
It's a chance to nerd out with Tom and I, and that always begins with the top stuff.
Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce in 1922, finds infant radio facilitates news gathering, as do many others in high public office.
Thomas.
Well, Star Fury Zeta kicks us off. If you're wondering, how does he do that? He goes to currentgeek.reddit.com, as do many other things and folks, and lets us know what stories they want to hear. Star Fury Zeta is all over this episode, actually. He submitted a ton of links, but you can too. So go to currentgeek.reddit.com. Star Fury Zeta sends the news that Warner Brothers Games pulled the Windows version of Batman Arkham Knight due to numerous reports of performance issues. If you've already purchased the game, you can still play it, but users can go to Steam or retail locations to purchase a game refund if you're having problems. Right now, the game is showing a mostly negative review status on Steam, 8,700 reviews logged. Apparently, it's fine on Xbox, though.
Yeah, and if you're me, you got lucky and it works great on PC. I was very excited about that game. I got it. I didn't see any of the negative press yet or anybody complaining about performance, and I loaded it up and had zero problems running everything on max. I just got a new video card, which may contribute to not having an issue, but it appears that there are some even with my card having that problem. And it's, you know, we're in that phase of video game time or even product time where so much of what we release to the public now, whether it's video games or other stuff, it feels like there's more day one patches, there are more bugs to worry about because everything's connected, everything's, you know, much bigger, more complicated than it used to be. Gone are the days, Tom, where you could just go, I don't know, buy Super Mario Kart for the Super NES on a cartridge and stick it in and expect it to play perfectly from top to bottom. You know, we're in a different time. And I feel like as much as we want to complain that, developers are too lazy to get it right the first time, I think some of it just comes down to how complicated this stuff is. And And I guess they're doing the right thing by offering.
I want to clarify something real quick. Amazing Toaster in the chat room is like, you have to purchase your game refund. I'm not sure how I phrased this, but you have to go to Steam or the retail location where you purchased the game to get your refund. You do not have to buy the refund.
So when a big,
that wouldn't make any damn sense.
Right. And when a big publisher like this says, hey, we're going to pull it so you can't purchase it now until we work this out, that seems like good customer service. Juan, does that seem like the right? Did WB do the right thing by saying, you know, we're going to hold this for a while until we work it out?
Well, I think in general, like, it's good to, you know, people have higher expectations these days of how products work. So generally good to, you know, if it's not going to meet expectations of what a customer wants to see, better to hold it and make sure people are happy once they get it. And like you said before, like, these things are hard. They're so highly optimized now because you're trying to squeeze, these games are so visually rich now that you have to squeeze so much out of the hardware. You're really trying to optimize. It's hard to get it all right.
Yeah, it's frustrating. And the thing I've run into with other games like this, and again, my experience, totally smooth, no problems. I don't know why I got touched by an angel this week, but Zippo, just not an issue. But when I've had this in the past, there starts to become this groundswell of anger and stuff, Jenny, where fans of products like this want to band together and create a huge explosive nightmare on the internet because now everyone has a voice. And, you know, they may not do this if it was their washer dryer that didn't work on day one or something. But man, games can sure get people all worked up.
Absolutely. And I mean, I have to say, considering that all the Arkham games that have been previously released are still sitting in our to play pile. This is not something that has yet affected us, but I do think that video games are a different thing. Like, you are about to commit so much time and you get so into the world that that moment where, like, you tried to move while you're auto-saving and then you destroy your entire game. Mm-hmm. And it just, like, anything that causes a break in the momentum of the storytelling is just, I won't lie, it's rage-inducing. So I understand why, even if it is a small percentage of the games actually sold, we don't know what the percentage is, but why it's so very frustrating.
Well, the good news is that this mostly seems to be affecting people with either lower-end cards, possibly AMD cards are a bit of an issue here. And they are reportedly committed to fixing this, so I think they'll get around to what is maybe the best game of the year. I'm just about ready to call it that. It's really fantastic.
Well, and I think that's what's really interesting is that we've gotten to the point where we evaluate the game companies based on how they respond to their game problems, and we really hopefully we'll get to a point where networking and delivery systems and complex architecture and cross-platform are figured out enough that we have fewer of these game problems. But it is kind of a fact of life that when you launch a game, there's a good chance something is going to go wrong. And there's a pretty decent chance that something could make your game unplayable.
Well, especially on a hardware platform that has so much variables with so much different hardware. Everyone's got different configurations. There's no way to plan for one set model the way you can with a console like a PS4 and Xbox One or whatever. So it's inherently more complicated. And when they haven't clearly done enough testing out of the gate, they're left with, you know, a little bit of blood on their hands. So hopefully they'll fix this problem and get it out there, because I think it's one of the best games of the year, without question.
Jeff Rose let us know that Miles Morales is becoming the face of Spider-Man post Secret Wars. The new series will be led by writer Brian Michael Bendis and artist Sarah Pacelli, who created the character in 2011. Peter Parker will still be around and serve as a mentor for Morales.
This is all ahead of the Marvel Cinematic Universe getting little Spider-Man there in their next movie. That will be Peter Parker, however. Jenny, you think it's too broad an expectation to expect Marvel and Sony to do the Morales Spider-Man and not Peter Parker again?
Leaving aside any snarky comments I might have about movie studios, I will say that they probably want to let the comic book universe lead and develop as they always have done, and then have another opportunity to reboot Spider-Man. I mean, why reboot it now when you could reboot it 3 years from now?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Juan, what are you thinking about that? Are you a big Spider-Man fan? Do you like him?
You know, I'm a fan. I like the story. I like the original movies. I was going to say, you know, why reboot it in 3 years or now? Do both. That's what these guys generally seem to opt to do. It's like, let's tell a story every summer.
If it wasn't for the split IP where Sony has the rights to the Spider-Man stories and kind of has to let Marvel have it back, if they want to put it into the Avengers, I'd say the perfect thing to do would be to come up with a Miles Morales like storyline separately, right? But Sony's not going to want to do that because they want to have the tie-in so people go see their version of the movie. And then, of course, Marvel doesn't have the right to do Miles Morales on its own without getting Sony's approval because it's still Spider-Man, still the spider suit and everything. So it's too complex, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Netflix.
Yeah.
Is that the answer? So that may be the answer to a lot of my Marvel questions. The more I enjoyed Daredevil, the more I realized that you could pretty much float all of their extemporaneous non-core Avengers type characters onto a service like that, or onto even a television station that isn't the internet only, and give me, you know, good quality long form storytelling.
Except I think Sony still owns Spider-Man.
Yeah, either way, right? Like they just they'll do what they're gonna do. But maybe
or has the rights. They don't
why couldn't they approach Netflix or somebody and saying, hey, we saw what you did here and we still want Marvel to help us with this and we're willing to make a deal. That could happen.
Do it, Sony.
I think there was a poem written about this once, which was by Frost, that said, two Spider-Men diverged in a road and I chose the one that was in front of my couch.
Nice.
That's a classic. I love that
beautiful
poem. Yeah.
Star
Fury Zeta wanted us to pour a little out for Donald Featherstone on our lawns. Next to that pink plastic flamingo that Featherstone created in 1957 while working at Union Products in Leominster, Massachusetts. Donald Featherstone actually rose to president of Union Products until he retired in 1999. He was 79.
So he invented the actual pink flamingo plastic lawn ornament.
He did lots of stuff like that at Union Products, but the pink flamingo is his most famous work.
So, okay, that's interesting. I have a kind of a personal connection to one of those things. My grandmother had one.
Was a plastic pink flamingo?
She was one of the first. No, she had one in her backyard. She had a tiny little backyard, and we'd go over there. And there in the corner was always this pink flamingo. And I think as a young kid, it freaked me out because it never moved and just looked ominous. But as I got older, it became a thing you just expect to see going out there. And I remember the weekend after she passed away, we were all going to that house to like go through old boxes and kind of decide where this stuff's going to go, sell the house, maybe that kind of thing. And I went back there expecting to see this pink flamingo and it was gone. No one knows where it went. Yeah. I would have happily given it a home.
It came to life one day
and walked away.
But I mean, there are worse things in life, right? Like to have a legacy that's like the pink flamingo or the guy that made the first lawn gnome or whoever came up with the first fuzzy dice hanging from the back of your rear view or whatever. I think that's a pretty good legacy to leave.
Rest in pink, Donald. Rest in pink.
Yeah,
and talk about creative spirit too. Like, where did you get the idea that was super important to do?
Yeah, exactly. At some point, it came into your head that a plastic flamingo would be a good piece of decor in your backyard. And I don't know that you could ever argue to me that it ever truly was that. Like, it never really looked good, but it became so like standard and became this thing. There's a movie called Pink Flamingos. There's, you know, the entire, I guess, Miami thing is embodied in the idea of having fake flamingos in climates where flamingos would die. Like it's a fantastic legacy. I think it's great. So
And he was very humble about it. His wife would always be the one to bring it up at parties, according to this article. I think the other side of it too is he probably didn't think when he made the pink flamingo that it was his like crowning achievement. He, as far as what this article makes it sound like, he was just cranking out plastic products right and left. He's probably making snowmen and reindeer and jack-o'-lanterns and deer and pink flamingo. Why not? Like, what was it that made that one stick out so much?
Do you think he did the Tim Berners-Lee thing with the internet, or did he get like money every time a pink flamingo was sold?
Oh, no. Well, he was president of the company eventually, so I don't think he got royalties on the pink flamingo, but obviously he rose to success.
I wonder can I make a pink flamingo and not worry about copyright law and all
on
that?
The back of his pink flamingo. Well, Union Products went out of business, but they were purchased by someone and they still make the flamingos. So I don't know, man.
I love it. 2015, baby. Pink flamingos.
I'm not a flamingo lawyer.
Still, you play one on TV.
I don't play one on TV.
All right.
But you know who is a lawyer? Justice Elena Kagan of the Supreme Court. And Kuzdra pointed out that in her opinion for the court in Kimball versus Marvel Entertainment, which was a patent license fee case, she made a few quotes. This was Marvel versus Kimball. It was Kimball versus Marvel, but still.
Right.
Here are some of those quotes, Scott. The parties set no end date for royalties, apparently contemplating that they would continue for as long as kids want to imitate Spider-Man by doing whatever a spider can.
This is actually quoted out of her thing.
That is from her opinion.
Oh my gosh.
Here's all another right. one. Patents endow their holders with certain superpowers, but only for a limited time.
Okay.
To the contrary, the decision's close relation to a whole web of precedents mean that reversing it could threaten others.
Can't you get fired for this? Like, isn't this, this seems crazy to me.
For well, life, baby.
She even cited Stan Lee and Steve Ditko in proper legal citation style, writing, "What we can decide, we can undecide. But stare decisis teaches that we should exercise that authority sparingly." CF Stanley Stan Ditko, Amazing Fantasy number 15, Spider-Man page 13, 1962. In this world with great power, there must also come great responsibility.
That is hilarious to me. I you know, it's easy to, well, Juan is a guy who just got out of some meetings, and we all know how meetings can be. They can be long and tiring and important, but all that. It just seems like this is a great chunk of levity that you would not normally see in a court proceeding of this nature.
Yeah, I have all kinds of thoughts pop into my head because I had not yet heard about this until just these fantastic quotes. You know, I'm thinking about my Friday night and the possibility of a drink, and I'm wondering if these things are overlapping somehow, because that sounds like a quota that I would make after one scotch too many.
Perhaps. I would too. It's just crazy to me. Jenny, what do you think about I know you love this. Why am I even asking you?
I love this. Yeah. I'm a huge Supreme Court geek. I took like as many media law classes as I could in college. I almost tried to go to law school and then realized that would just be crazy. But what I love most about this is that Elena Kagan told the Supreme Court Law Review, or I think it's called the Supreme Court Review, it's a publication, that she's an avid comic book geek. So this isn't a case of her clerks going, tee-hee-hee. She is like into this. She and it's
Justice
so
Kagan's in her cups. We could slip in some quotes. No, she knew.
No, she did this. Yeah. It's just like, you know, these Supreme Court justices live a very, I don't want to say cosseted, but they are away from the public eye, and you tend to forget that they're human, except when they come out and, you know, change the course of human history once every couple of months. And I just think that this is a lovely reminder that these are real people who had real experiences and real things that they love. And even if we don't hear from them that often, they still have really awesome things to say.
Well, and not only that, the thing I take away from it, and I was just talking about this the other day, so it seems appropriate, but what's happening is we have somebody in the Supreme Court, a justice, who is making an opinion on a thing that this person clearly not only appreciates, probably grew up with. So, and probably grew up in a time when comic books were seen as the downfall of youth. They were going to mess all our kids up. They needed all these kind of crazy regulations. They were, you know, the devil, the 10-cent devil for parents. And it isn't unlike how, what the you know, sort of phase that video games went through in the late 80s through the late 2000s. And what's happening now is you have people in power or in public office who were raised on these things that were supposedly going to send all, you know, our kids to hell and back. And this is just a sign of that. That's just them saying, oh, no, this, we're going to have some fun with this. It's also something I love and I want to reference in this way. And there's no legal reason why I can't. And guess what? Comic books didn't ruin people. In fact, some people who appreciated it and read it, they grew up to be justices. So take that, comics code of 1950, whatever it was. Finally.
You're still upset about that.
I am still worked up over that.
Well, what's cool too is like these quotes actually make this a story, and it makes people sort of engage more in what's happening around it, and you know, thinking about the impact of the Supreme Court. So, actually communicating these things out in this way, as I'm sort of peeking through some of the coverage now, like really makes it humanizes it. And,
yeah, it's much more relatable.
That's a really good point. And how you know, I could actually share this with my teenager and say, Nick, come here, check this out, and he'd get it, and he'd laugh, and he'd,
hey,
he'd,
Nick, I have a patent decision to share with you.
What? Right?
No, seriously.
Normally, he would just go, whatever, Dad. But this is actually kind of interesting, and would fall in his, you know, in his interest.
I think so. my favorite is that she cited the principle: in this world with great power, there must also come great responsibility.
Yeah.
For a stare decisis example,
and like, that it was per pertinent. That's the best part.
No, it totally
is. That's how timeless those comics are, is that there is pertinent, amazing stuff within them.
Yeah, really good.
Also, now we know the proper wording of the quote, which people often paraphrase. It is, in this world with great power, there must also come great responsibility.
Yeah, people shorten it.
Yeah.
Like many things.
What they don't shorten, because you can't get any shorter, is Expelliarmus, the spell from Harry Potter. But online store Etsy has updated its guideline to ban the sale of spells and potions, so don't try to sell it there. The company prohibits all metaphysical services that promise a tangible outcome like revenge or weight loss or blowing Marjorie Dursley up like a balloon. Vendors who sell these items are being disapparated from Etsy, and they are not pleased after being driven off of eBay in 2012. Do these companies not understand with whom they are meddling?
Oh, man. These are the ultimate muggles. Yeah, you know what? You probably shouldn't be in the business of helping people sell things marked as, like, potions that would make, you know, your mother-in-law disappear or whatever. That seems bad on the surface of it. And again, I don't know that anyone should swoop in and try to regulate it, because in some cases it's just silly. But, you know, a company like Etsy or eBay, they have the right to get rid of weirdness.
Well, it is regulated. You cannot sell something under fraud.
That's true.
You can't say it will make your grandmother disapparate and it doesn't. Like, you just can't. That's against the law. And what Etsy's trying to do is saying, you know what? We're a publicly traded company now. We can't risk a lawsuit over somebody being promised that they will have weight loss from a potion and not.
They sell it as literal, right? I mean, I'm assuming that this is only being torn down because it's one thing to go to a store and say, oh, I can buy a little bottle that says mana on it, and it's like my World of Warcraft character's mana flask, and that's cool. I've seen those, and that's a thing you can do, and it's got harmless blue water in it or something. These are being sold as things that are supposed to work.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, geez. I didn't realize it was that literal, man.
And, you know, I get it. Etsy, it's hard to go through and figure out which ones work and which ones don't.
Is he going to vet all these? I don't know. Any other thoughts from our panel?
Yeah, I think that if you're going around on Etsy and selling beautifully framed versions of spells you wrote, like if it's a creative project and it's a spell you wrote and it's very like you could hang it up on a wall, that seems fine to me. But if you're going around selling some bottle that says we'll make grandma disappear and who knows what's in the bottle, I think there's like a whole agency designed to regulate that. So,
yeah. Assuming grandma's got to drink it too, right? It's a potion after all. I don't know. Juan, any thoughts?
I think, you know, just everybody's trying to uphold their responsibility to, you know, if you buy one thing that's like that and it's all misrepresented and you don't know what it is, like, and I guess there is probably somebody out there who would really believe there is a mother-in-law potion and be disappointed when it came and realized it was just Kool-Aid. But hey, you know, I think everybody's just trying to do the right thing to help make sure that only reputable things are floating around out there.
But yeah.
it's a hell of a good story to talk about and debate. What other potions?
I completely agree. It's so funny how, I don't know, I can't believe people believe that stuff works. But then again, I'm always shocked that spam still works, and it's just a numbers game, like Tom always tells me, and somebody somewhere is clicking on spam.
Well, I'm sure they'll all move on to PaySpell.
Oh, great.
Be fine.
All right.
Surprise truck! I always feel like I have to say his name like that. Wanted us to talk about Undo Send. It's a new standard feature on Gmail. It's actually been in Gmail Labs since 2009, but they've rolled it out now. It's rolling out to you in your Gmail soon if you don't have it already. It allows you to hit send, then for a limited amount of time, press an undo option. You have 5 seconds by default. You can actually go into your settings and change that to either 10, 20, or 30 seconds. It's only an option while you're on the view of that email, though. You click away, you lose that option, and it doesn't really unsend it. All it does is delay the sending of the email for that 5, 10 seconds or more so that you get a chance to undo and just not send it.
So call me. I don't know what you call me, but I thought this was rolled out a long time ago. I guess I had
it was
the
in
labs
2009
thing.
In labs. That's why you think that.
I guess I just had it and thought, I must have forgotten that it was in labs, because for me, this is something I use all the time already. And I just, when I heard it this week, I'm like, wait, you guys have been doing this for years now, but I guess it's official and not a beta.
Yeah. It's just in there for everybody now.
Wow. Has everyone here been using it the way I have, or is this a revelation to Gmail users?
I feel like it would make me lazy, Scott. So that's why you get those typo-filled emails.
Well, I've had a couple of moments where it's really saved me. Like, I had an email that was going to somebody who I really, they didn't need to see the numbers that were in there, and hit send and went, oh, no, and undid. And it totally saved me. Although there have been a couple of times where I went to send it, went to undo it, and even though I was within the 5 seconds, because Gmail servers were churning or whatever the reason was, there was some delay in it, and it said, oh, sorry, couldn't do it. So it wasn't perfect. Hopefully now it's,
Change it to 30 seconds.
Well, maybe I just should. I'm going to do that.
They give them to you, take them.
Yeah, but if I leave the email, like Tom was saying, then it doesn't matter, right? So am I going to just, I'm not going to, like usually what I'll do is send and then I'm off to doing other stuff, assuming I'm using the web interface. I don't want to go, you know.
And this only works in the web.
It only works in the web interface.
Although it also works in the app. The Gmail app and the Inbox app.
Yeah, and if you use... Oh, it does work in the Inbox app now.
Yeah,
all right.
It's worked in the Inbox app for a while now.
Actually, I was unaware of that. Well, there you have it. Thanks, Google. Thank you for rolling out a thing I thought I already had. well, we got one more of these. What else is going on?
Oh, yeah. Star Fury Zeta sent the news that a week and a half after its release, Fallout Shelter is now the top downloaded App Store game in 48 countries around the world. Bethesda Softworks' free mobile game is also the most downloadable app of any kind in 25 countries. Fallout Shelter is currently in development for Android devices, so you can expect that number to rise, and that's why I've been looking down through the whole show.
Yeah, I can hear it. Listen to that, you guys. That is the sound of addiction for Tom. That's kind of all you've done since it came
out. No, I was really just doing that so I could play those sounds while I read it. It's the only reason I kept playing that.
It's the only reason it's been open the entire time today and will be for the rest of the night.
Really, I'm going to close it down because it's awful.
It's pretty interesting to see. I mean, everybody makes an app, a companion app. There's strategy to doing that. But a lot of times it's like really brutal on the free-to-play stuff where you got to pay to do anything, you know, whatever. But this seems like a game that is designed to get the word out about Fallout, get people excited again about a Fallout game, and give them something genuinely fun to play that isn't punishing when it comes to that, the microtransaction world that we all live in now. And that's pretty nice. If you want to go buy stuff, you can buy those lunch boxes, get gear and stuff like that. But it seems like more and more, this is going to be the way these things go because people are tired of getting nickel and dime, but they still want to pay for stuff that's good. So Juan, you're in the business of that or helping facilitate that in a lot of cases. Does this seem like a better model than the ones that say, well, to continue, you need to pay us $5 or $1 or whatever, and instead here's a game that you can actually play and get some good fun out of and not worry about getting nickeled and dimed every 5 minutes?
Yeah, it's a good appetizer. I mean, like with the kinds of people that we get to work with, people want to deliver value because consumers are expecting to get some value out of it. But at the same time, I think this is almost a little bit different than a lot of use cases we see in that it really is kind of like the appetizer model. It's like, hey, check this out. Like, it's a stepping stone to get there. And, you know, it's something that you can actually, I have not played with it yet myself.
Don't.
That's like one of those, I don't need yet another game addiction. So sure. Like, it's kind of like, you know, here, just try this just once. And so, you know, if you can do something fun with it, like, you know, why not? What's the problem?
Yeah, I like it. It's free. Play it. It's addicting. Tom will never stop. Jenny, you bought the dumb wrist thing. Have you been playing this too?
I didn't buy it. It was handed down to me from my boss, and I successfully waited a whole week.
He means
week.
The Pip-Boy.
Pip-Boy. I thought you meant the Apple Watch.
I know. It was confusing which dumb wrist thing he was talking about. But unching. Apologies, Apple fans. We're just kidding.
Sorry. Yeah, please email Tom. That was my fault.
I
went all week hearing about it and didn't download it. And then Friday after DTNS, I finally downloaded Fallout Shelter. So, Tom, it was lovely working with you.
Yeah. We really enjoyed our time together. For both
Daily
of
Tech
you,
News show was a fine show before Fallout Shelter came out. We'll miss it.
All right. Well, there's that. And that means we are at the point of the show where we ask our listener or our guest some important questions for the pop quiz.
America scores and wins.
All right. America does score and win today. Juan, we do this every week. We have guests come on. They get asked questions in areas of their expertise. If they get answers correctly, they hear this. If they get it wrong, they hear this. And at the end, Tom takes his score and puts it together, and we see how you do on the average. There is zero pressure. It is all for good fun. Are you comfortable and ready for your questions?
Zero pressure, but we are keeping score.
Just a little score. Just a little, evaluation
view of as a person. No.
Apparently, Iceborne made Jenny some questions the cuff.
I'll pull those up after this, and then we can have a real competition. All right, I like this. Right. We'll start.
This is making it even worse.
We'll start with Wands, and here is your category. It is cycling, because we know you're a big fan of cycling. I don't want to say expert. I don't want to get in trouble. So here we go. First question, and there are 8 of these. Who won the very first Tour de France in 1903?
They start easy.
Let's see. I can't even come up with a funny answer to that.
Yeah, like Pepe.
I give up.
you know, old Pepe in 1903. All right, here we go. Let's see. Oh, it was Maurice Green. Or sorry, Maurice Garin is the correct answer.
Maurice Garin.
Thanks for letting me know. Next question. After Lance Armstrong was stripped of his wins, what is the most amount of wins any one cyclist has in the Tour de France?
Oh, after Lance? It's either 2 or 3. I'm going to go, I think it's 2.
The answer is apparently not that. It's 5. Miguel Indurain, Jacques, and I can't read these names.
See, you're losing points.
This after the Tour de France this year. Like, that gives me 21 days to listen to all this and get warmed up again. But, you know, doing it the week before, like, I'm not a great...
That's like jumping on your bike without stretching, right? You know? It's not a good thing.
I feel
bad. We're gonna give you bicycle.
We're gonna give you 0.4 because you got 2 out of the 5. That's 40%.
See, he scores this really strange. It's all good. Next one. What year was the first Tour of Britain cycling event held?
That one I know for a fact. Just kidding. That would be, I believe, 1964.
Oh, you're close, but not really. It is 1945 was the correct answer.
Oh, so he gets 0.75.
6 and 5 are pretty close.
Yeah. Well, he got 3 of the 4 digits, right?
Yeah, that's not bad. All right, how's this one? Who is the president of the CTC? That's the National Cycling Charity. And I'll give you a hint with this one. He is a prominent character in either the books or the TV adaptation of Game of Thrones. Same name as that guy, as that character.
The character or the actor?
The character.
Oh, okay. The clue is more confusing than helping.
I'll tell you. I'll give you a further clue, which is
Tyrion Lannister.
If this person could be accused at the CTC national or the CTC annual meeting of not knowing anything.
Oh.
If that helps somebody else, chime in. I'm all looking.
I think it helped Jenny.
Speaking on behalf of Juan as his pop quiz attorney, I would say the first name is probably John, or the last name is probably Snow.
You are correct. John Snow is the answer.
Good job, Juan.
Yeah,
well
good
done.
Job. What do we call that? They handed it off. They did well. What country has the most amount of bikes per capita? I'll just tell you, it is not the United States, if that helps.
For sure.
Texas.
You're kind of close.
I'm thinking, okay, we're going to go... I'm going to throw out China, just see what happens.
All right, let's see what happens. Checking. Nope. Netherlands, apparently.
What? Yeah, no. Oh, percentages.
How is that close to Texas?
Said that wrong. I said, it's not in the United States. You said Texas, and I said you're close, meaning it's not, sometimes not feeling like it's in the United States.
Gotcha.
Sorry, Texas. You can send me your emails. It's fine. Next one, third to last, here we go. The Tour de France sometimes starts outside of France. Where did the 2014 event start?
Was that one in Spain?
You are incorrect. It was Leeds, England. Well, Leeds in the United Kingdom, yeah.
That's right. They just set the new 24, the new fastest, time too by the writer who was there too, but even his name escapes me at this point, so.
It's all right,
I'm struggling.
It's how it works. Next one. What is the oldest bicycle company still in existence? I wish it was Huffy, but that is not the answer.
Let's see, how about Huffy?
It's not Schwinn either.
I was gonna say that was my first.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Could it be
Lotus.
It couldn't be Specialized.
Well, let's find out. Is it Specialized? Nope. It is Bianchi.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Is that a real name?
I'm gonna all give right. you a half point because nobody would know
Bianchi.
That.
Bianchi.
Yeah, or Bianchi. All right. Yeah, nobody would know that.
I get a point for knowing how to pronounce that. Right?
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Completely agree.
Perhaps two, in fact.
Final question. Whose death forced the UCI or Union Cycliste Internationale to require all racers wear to wear helmets during endorsed races? And I'll tell you, the person died in 2003, so it was kind of recent.
Yeah, let's see. Well, I could look it up, but I'm not going to. I think... I don't remember. I will say this, like, while I have the moment to say this, like, yeah. I have seen so many people that still ride without helmets.
Yeah.
Like, just don't do it. I even had a friend wipe out once and he didn't remember it because he woke up in a helicopter ride to the hospital.
Oh,
so,
man.
Wear helmets. Wear helmets.
Wear a helmet. I think that's a good thing. Even though you got it wrong, it's still good that you said that.
Andre. No, I didn't have a point for that.
Yeah, it's
my
good.
Wife always gets angry when she's driving and she sees someone riding a bicycle without a helmet.
Yeah. I've been known to roll down my window and say, get a helmet, and then drive off like a jerk.
I could totally see you doing that.
Oh,
good for you guys. That's I do the same. That's
it's important. Andre Kivilev, who died in 2003.
Kivilev?
Yeah. Yeah, that was much better than me. So there's your answers. Now, we have this other set. I just got to pull these up real quick. This is fantastic how quickly you put these together.
He said there are typos.
Well, that's
He's
fine.
Guaranteed to include typos because he had to work fast.
You're guaranteed I'll probably read them. Where are they, Mike? I don't see them.
Said they're in the Dropbox.
Oh, but. You know, that would help if I had Dropbox running because now that'll pull that down very quickly here. I should have done that before.
I thought that's where you were looking. Sorry.
I should have checked before. All right, here we go. They're coming down.
What would Spider-Man do?
It's coming. Yeah, what would Spider-Man do? Jenny, hold tight. We don't know what your category is, do we?
I know. It's so nerve-wracking.
All of human knowledge.
All right. I'd actually do better at that probably than some specific category.
Well, what was our last one that we did with
Lord of the Rings,
We did
right?
Dark Tower. We've done Tolkien.
Dark. Didn't we?
Tolkien twice and Dark Tower once.
Oh, that's right. Didn't we do... Okay, here it is. Didn't we do... Yeah, that's right. We did that twice. I always get confused about what we did with you. All right, here we go. Found it. Happy are we. Here it is. Oh, Chris Pratt trivia.
Yes!
We know you like Chris Pratt. All right. Number first. When is Chris Pratt's birthday?
July.
Oh, you're so close, literally, but it's June 21st.
Yeah, I don't know it at all. I just decided.
Just happened.
You didn't get him anything?
He felt like a July.
All right. Who does Chris Pratt play on Parks and Recreation? And you're not much of a Chris Pratt fan all of a sudden.
This could
Andy?
Be a competition after
all.
You are correct. It is Andy, but do you know the last name?
I do.
I'm going to give you...
No.
I think we give her this, which is both, because it is Andy, but the last name's Dwyer.
Yes! Oh,
Tom can decide how to score that.
0.75. Andy's the more important part of that name.
Very good. What is the character Chris Pratt played is hard to say fast, in the Lego movie?
Oh, no. He was adorable.
Yeah.
the lead in the Lego movie's name was Adorable Worker Guy.
Incorrect. It is Emmett Brickowski.
Emmett Brickowski. It was so close.
Emmett.
Well, I think you're getting 0.6 for that, though, because you pretty much described the... spirit of the character.
Yeah, that wasn't bad. What is Chris Pratt's middle name?
Adorable.
Michael is, I think it's pronounced Michael.
Oh, okay.
What was the first short film Chris Pratt was credited in? He really dug. Go ahead.
Nope, it's not that
one. I don't know. It's not happening.
Cursed Part 3.
Yeah, I wouldn't have gotten
that. That was not nearly as good as Cursed 2. That's why I didn't watch it.
Right. Cursed. Where was Chris Pratt born? Cursed Pratt.
Atlanta?
Virginia, Minnesota. Which sounds like two states together.
I could have guessed twice.
That's amazing.
That's weird. Second to last question. What did Chris Pratt and Anna Faris collect before they met?
Bugs.
Look at you. They collected dead bugs. They combined their collections when they got married.
The only reason I know that is because I work for the Morning Stream.
Oh, no way. Because you found that in there?
Found that there at some point. Going Frog, through feed.
Frogpants.com/TMS, everybody. 4 days a week. Check it out.
Lots of bug news.
Finally, last question. What is the name of Chris Pratt's son, his real life son?
Oh, I don't know, but boy, were they adorable on their front porch saying, learning the Pledge of Allegiance on Memorial Day. It was super cute, and the kid is blonde, but I do not know his name because I respect the privacy of celebrity people's children along with all children.
I see what you've done with that question. I see. the answer is Jack. Jack is the answer. Well done. Actually, this is a lot closer than I thought it was going to be, Tom. How'd they do?
All right, yeah. So between impassioned speeches about bike helmet safety and the privacy rights of celebrity children, we have a close race here. Jenny Josephson with 3.351 and Juan with 4.15.
Wow, look at this. Wow. Juan, you've done it. You came in here your first time and you nailed it. Nice job.
You have to believe after my performance there that this was rigged.
Believe whatever you need to.
Yeah, whatever makes you helps you sleep at night.
All I have to say to that is Hemsworth.
That's right. Hemsworth is great. All right, we have enough time, I think, for forecast. We'll rip through this one.
The future promises even more startling things to come.
So I had this thought. This, by the way, is a segment called Forecast. It used to be a show. Now it's a segment. It's about the future. We try to predict it a little bit on the show. Sometimes we're a little goofy about it. Sometimes we're serious. This one I actually think is kind of serious. I think digital consumerism will fix the problems caused by a lot of what we have with actual consumerism, meaning paper products, things that get thrown away, landfill items, even plastics and recyclables, that at some point we will be getting so much of what we like digitally, and that includes much smaller devices that project big images for instead of having a big expensive television that'll get tossed in 10 years, things like that, that we will have so much digital stuff generally that in the end we'll end up getting to where we want to be in terms of renewables and trash consumption and all of that just naturally because so much of what we do will become digital. And, you know, you can't get away from it completely, but that's a lot of paper that we still use. I just signed some life insurance papers the other day. My gosh, those people are stuck in the paper age, man. Like, there is no doubt that there are still places we can improve what we do with security and digital stuff. So, thoughts? Anybody think I'm up in the night? Do you think this is a good prediction?
I'll start. I think half and half is what I would say, because I think you're right. There are definitely places that innovation is still going to drive evolution. And, you know, another one is photography. Just look at that example. You know, we used to have mountains and mountains of these physical photos and the mountains, even larger amounts of chemicals to process all those things. Like, most of that has gone away. So that's one good example of how we've gone. And you're right about legal documents. Mortgage is another good one, you know, to go through. At the same time, you know, I find like myself thinking about like my own sort of consumables and waste, and so much of it is actually around more day-to-day things. And what we as humans ourselves are sort of eating, and, you know, all those, gosh, every day you just walk down the sidewalk and you see like so much trash created from those things. So I think, you know, I think there are definitely places where we've seen it happen and we'll see more of it. But, you know, the, you know, in some ways digitization also, as much as I'm a fan of that and a part of that and we support it, you know, you also, you know, when you order like these on-demand delivery things, like, you know, you do Google Express, for example, and there's like all these things sort of showing up. Like, I don't know if that's actually, you know, more green sometimes than what I would normally do to go out of the store and pick it all up from one spot. So I think there's trade-offs, because sometimes the simplicity of the things that we might do actually allows us to do things that we might otherwise unnaturally do. And like some of those home delivery things are actually an example of that for me. So
yeah, even the idea of like lots of, you know, like music is all digital now, is thinking we may be saving on CDs and cases and paper products and things like that, but there's still servers that are now there churning away, burning different kind of fuel, causing us to have to lose other kinds of resources more quickly maybe. So it seems like that's kind of along the lines of what you said. Jenny, what are your thoughts?
My thought was along the lines of you know, the trade-offs. For example, Tom for Christmas gave me a subscription to Blue Apron, right? And so that's the thing that delivers the food you're going to make in pre-prepared. It's all exact to the amount you have to cook it, instructions, and I love it. I adopt it full on. And they take great care to make sure that the packaging they send you, like in a big cardboard box, and inside all the stuff is wrapped in plastic, and it's got the freezer packs and the whole thing. So you're generating an awfully lot of consumer waste, even though most, like 90% of it is recyclable, in order to prevent food waste, right? Because if you buy like a huge amount of stuff, you may not, like a lot of food tends to go to waste when you buy it in bulk. And so there's that trade-off. And then talk about the energy expended to get the food to me in the mail when I could have just gone to the grocery store and picked it up. So I often think about that and think like, how am I netting out in terms of like guilt for packaging waste, which is a thing I think about actually a lot. Mm-hmm. So I haven't quite solved that, but Blue Apron has made me eat healthier. And I feel like it will give me the brain power to solve that problem at some point.
Tom, any parting thoughts on this?
You know, I think it's a big picture item, right? You can definitely see, and Juan and Jenny have both given great examples of where technology has caused us to actually use more resources. There are certainly more cardboard boxes kicking around these days in my neck of the woods than there used to be, because so many things are being delivered. You buy them off Amazon, Uber delivers food, you know, all of this kind of stuff. But I think in the larger picture, I definitely have fewer things in my house than I used to. Because when I buy a book, it doesn't sit on a shelf. When I buy music, it doesn't sit on a shelf. There are lots of things I do that are cutting out the amount of things around. And I don't have any evidence of this. I'm sure you could look it up and try to find out what's going on. But I imagine that net-wise, we're either even or maybe a little ahead on just things in general. That the amount of things that we've raised with Blue Aprons and box shipping is outweighed or balanced out by the things we've saved. And I do think that over time, Scott, your forecast is probably going to become more true. That's my gut feeling. I don't have any evidence for that, but I feel like we will solve some of these problems. We will make packaging smaller. We will make it easier for Blue Apron to send you things without using as much packaging. There will be certain kinds of things that won't need packaging anymore. And you know, the drone will deliver it and just drop it right into your hands, and it won't even have styrofoam around it. So, you know, I mean, I that's a silly example, but I think we are concerned with that. All of the companies are concerned with that. And so I think we'll continue to reduce the amount of resources, if for no other reason than it's less costly to deliver your product that way.
I completely agree. All right, we're going to use the last part of the show, which we normally do for emails, to talk a little bit about what Juan actually does. And I find it kind of fascinating because we're now living in this time where people want to pay for stuff with their phones and their watches and their, you know, their tiny devices that send little chip readers to things. And we all want to get apps that make it really easy for us to do things. And if I want to order a pizza, I don't want to, you know, kill myself trying to figure out how to pay for it or have enough cash in my pocket. And I think there's probably a whole generation of, you know, college kids that are coming up that are trying to figure out, you know, what is their, you know, day-to-day kind of financial life look like. And it's starting to look very digital and a lot less papery and a lot, speaking of which, and you guys do a lot of that stuff. Tell me what Braintree's core model is and what are you guys up to these days?
Yeah, well, I think very fundamentally, we're a payments platform, and we're here to power payments through simple yet powerful tools that lets really great innovators that we get to work with a lot do amazing things. And we've talked about some of them here. You know, the Munchies of the world delivering food on demand, Uber, and the ability that brings you, Airbnb, and many others. So that's the core of what we do. And a lot of the principle that we've focused on has been around helping merchants solve this problem around not just the digitization of commerce that we've been talking about, but the fact that more and more statistics are now showing that mobile devices are the primary computing platform. Mm-hmm. And while more and more people spend more and more time browsing on tablets and phones than they do on a desktop platform, it's generally much harder to buy for things on those platforms. So merchants are sort of struggling with that shift to mobile where people are spending more time there, but it's harder to purchase. But overall, that's what we do. We get to operate globally and help innovators build fantastic products because we take care of the headaches of payments and give them powerful tools to own their experiences and do magical things for customers on top of us.
Is it starting to seem like, well, to me, it seems like the big up and coming generation, let's say the 20 somethings, are the ones that are going to be the ones that sort of spearhead this change, or are going to be they're going to be there while the change occurs? Has that been your experience?
Well, they'll certainly be there. I think that, I think you see both angles. I think you see the ubiquity of the products that we just talked about. And by the way, this sort of overall model of sharing and reuse we were talking about before, like you think of what Uber and Airbnb can do, for example, of making utility out of things that would otherwise be unused, right? So now you have a car, it wasn't going to be used. Now, guess what? It's a taxi for someone else. And you had a room that wasn't going to be used. Guess what? It's a hotel for somebody else. So that's an interesting trend kind of relating to the topic we saw before. But you also see pretty fairly ubiquitous services around these things. And if you look at the statistics, and recently there have been more articles published that literally there is more time spent on mobile devices than not, that's not isolated to a particular segment of consumers. That's not a particular trend in 20-somethings or millennials. That you have to have ubiquity at that point to see such drastic change in those statistics. And so, the data here, I think, is not lying to us that there's definitely going to be early adoption and people sort of choosing one service or one product or another and pushing things. But, when you get to the point that these services are reaching at such scale and you see these statistics, it's pretty undeniable. One example of that is something like Venmo, a social payments app that came into Braintree and then now is part of PayPal with us. And people oftentimes think of that as something that's attributed more to a certain, consumer audience of younger people. But that's a platform that handled $1.3 billion in payments just in the first quarter of this year.
Wow, that's a lot.
So that's not a narrow, that's not a narrow segment anymore. Like you're seeing these things really take off and grow really rapidly. So yeah, I think there's certain demographics that'll push things, but we're seeing ubiquity in a lot of things now too.
So if you're a guy making an app, let's say, and part of you're two guys in a basement, right? Got one guy doing art, the other guy's programming it, and you're like, man, we're going to really disrupt the market. We got this great new idea. Why is it so hard still for people to fit, the payment part is just hard. And it's always kind of been hard, even on the web, on desktop, it's always sort of been hard. We've gotten better at it. It's like, well, we can store your credit cards and this stuff's secure and we got ways to autofill and there's like conveniences that have come over time. But for somebody who's just trying to make a really great service, the last thing they want to do is worry about how to do all the payment stuff. And I guess that's where you guys come in.
Yeah, that's really a lot of our focus is I think big push towards open source, macro shift towards, software platforms that can help you with a variety of different capabilities. Payments is probably one that's just the perfect example of that because the complexity it's traditionally had. Before a platform like ours existed, you would have to integrate with an extremely difficult or complex API. You would have to go get a merchant account, a bank, a relationship established so you could process credit cards with that. And there are lots of moving pieces there, and sometimes a lot of people who want to, take their piece of the pie along the way too. So you get a lot of hidden fees, and if you're confused about how to do it, who do you call? How do you find out what a chargeback is? All these things that are out there, and the two guys or gals in a garage who are trying to figure out, hey, what's the next new thing I can go build? Like they don't know how to solve all those things. So for us, we put together, a powerful technology suite that's really simple and easy to use. You can build something big and powerful on it. You can build something quick and simple on it just as well. You can get merchant account services from us directly. You come and sign up and you spend a minute or two on our form and then you're able to move forward and start processing transactions. In fact, in Europe, you can just give us an email address and get going and process live transactions right away. And so all those things like reduce the friction and let the innovation happen. We're happy to get to work with some great innovators and then also other great innovative platforms like Slack and GitHub. And then the other shift you're seeing now is that these app developers now have to think about all these different mobile wallet options that are out there. And so just in the last 9 months, sort of us at PayPal have this one-touch mobile wallet. Apple Pay goes live to tremendous fanfare for iOS users. Google just launches Android Pay at Google I.O. about a month ago, also to a lot of notoriety. And so an app developer now has to not only figure out their experience and how you're going to process payments, but how you're also going to integrate all these new payment methods that are evolving on these different platforms. And so we try to give them an abstraction that will give them access with one integration to all these different tools as well.
Well, BraintreePayments.com is the place to go. People can check it out and see more of what's happening over there. Play in the sandbox, mess around with it. It's really fascinating to me how this stuff's evolving and so quickly. So I appreciate you taking time to chat about it. Jenny, what are you doing? Do you want to pimp anything here at the end of the show?
I'm going to pimp it out hard. In addition to my amazing job where I work with Tom Merritt on Daily Tech News Show and ripping headlines from the headline device for TMS, I host and produce with my husband Matt Flanagan a podcast called TellItAnyway.com. No, it's really just called Tell It Anyway, but I've now also told you where to find it. And it's a storytelling podcast where three people get together and tell three different stories, sort of centered around one general topic. Tom has been on it. I have my sights set on Scott Johnson. It has been a lot of fun. And we got a beautiful email yesterday from someone who's a former military, lives in Lake Charles. He said 12 hours away from his friends and family. And he said that just hearing us talk to our friends made him happy. And I was like, okay, now I'm going to do it forever.
That's all it takes, right?
Really awesome.
Yeah. Well, it's cool. TellItAnyway.com. Nice grab, by the way. It's hard to get domains like that anymore. Jeez. Mm-hmm. Please do. And Tom, you got anything else before we...
I got a bunch of your drawings.
Oh, yeah, look at that.
Collected together and then wrote 365 days worth of history of technology around.
I had fun doing that. I know you had fun writing it, so
yeah,
people should have
check
fun
it out.
It.
The Year in Tech History. You can find it at TomMerrittBooks.com or wherever books are sold, and then you will be smarter than everyone else and have Scott Johnson illustrations to look at as well.
There you go. Big, big thanks again. Juan, thanks for being here. Oh, we lose him?
Oh, I'm still here.
There you are. Thanks for being here, man. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Great to hang with you guys, Tom and Scott. Nice to meet you as well, Jenny.
Nice to meet you, Juan.
Yeah, Jenny, thanks for hanging out with us as always.
Thank you.
And what else? I guess Iceworm, thanks for that last minute question thing. That was pretty nice of you. That's it. CurrentGeek.com is the place. If you want to catch the show and reruns and subscribe and all that stuff, CurrentGeek.com is definitely the place. At CurrentGeek on Twitter. I'm at Scott Johnson. Tom's at Ace Detect. And you can check us out at CurrentGeek.reddit.com as well. It's going to do it for us, for our guests, for me, and for Tom. We'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we review one of the two highlight decisions of this Supreme Court term, the healthcare decision in King v. Burwell, issued earlier this week, including a dissent that is one for the ages. For a second time, a challenge to the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, has reached the Supreme Court. Also for the second time, the administration earned a big victory against challengers to the healthcare law. No matter what side of the healthcare debate you fall on, two things are notable about this decision. First, a 6-3 majority of the court did not stop as expected at providing deference to an IRS rulemaking decision to allow for federal tax subsidies for insurance purchasers buying on federal and state insurance exchanges. Instead, the majority deemed that this is an issue of deep economic and political significance that should not be left to mere IRS rulemaking, which could later be overturned by another administration. In other words, the court decided that the correct reading of the legislative intent behind the law must absolutely mandate that subsidies be made available to consumers in all 50 states. Even though this holding is inconsistent with the way the law actually reads, the decision has bolstered this potential weak point in the healthcare law and has ensured that the critical financial subsidy backing portion of this law works for everyone. This is yet another case where the more liberal mindset of legislative intent duked it out with the more conservative mindset of strict interpretation of laws as written. This time, the legislative intent argument won. The second notable part of this decision is the scathing dissent from Justice Scalia, who is a staunch supporter of strict constructionist law interpretations. One can immediately understand why he's not amused that a law that reads one way is being interpreted to mean something wholly different by the majority. His dissent is worth a read for entertainment value alone, but here are some highlights. He says words no longer have meaning if an exchange that is not established by a state is interpreted to be covered by established by the state. He characterizes the majority opinion as interpretive jiggery-pokery and pure applesauce. Yes, applesauce. He then caps the dissent by observing that the court, rewriting the law to fix it so that the tax credits apply everywhere, should make people start calling the law SCOTUS care instead of Obamacare. The bottom line is, with two challenges now defeated, Obamacare appears to remain the signature achievement of the Obama presidency, and one that will not go away anytime soon. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and legal-themed questions or segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.